Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Stories of days and times that no longer exist in rural areas tell us how things were, how people worked, lived, and played, and bring to life conditions that most of us never knew existed. Walking Tractor and Other Tales of Old Anderson Valley is a collection of stories written by Bruce Patterson, who lives in Philo, California, a rather small community in rural Anderson Valley, located about in the middle of Mendocino County, approximately 120 miles north of the Golden Gate Bridge. The introduction to Walking Tractor quotes Ernest Hemingway as saying, "You can only write about what you know." Something that is verified in the stories of Bruce Patterson, who is known to his friends as Pat. I met with Pat in the studios of Radio Curious the last week of August 2006 to learn about his life, his stories, and the man he is. Well, Pat, welcome to Radio Curious here in our studios.
Thanks for having me.
So your book, Walking Tractor, tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it's I wanted to capture the old homesteader economy in Anderson Valley. Last 30 years, the valley's gone through a lot of different changes. And coming back from the war, I went to work in the woods. I kind of fell in love with that old way of life, outdoors. And
well, describe that old way of life for us.
It was a lot of hard work.
Yeah, well, life is.
But like the loggers were the ranchers and the ranchers were the loggers. People took their living from the land and it was seasonal. People were tied to the place and to the seasons. And taking what they could from the land, be it redwood or corn or livestock. Whole different way of life than what we have now.
Well, in your book, Walking Tractor, you describe in considerable detail the different ways of life, the ranchers, the loggers, the homesteaders. Tell us some of your investigations and how you were able to put it down in writing.
Well, just from experience, I was evoking old conversations or old characters rather than creating them. And, you know, I spent 32 years working ranches, farming, logging, wood cutting, did a lot of wood cutting. And so I met a lot of the old guys, and I worked with them. And when you're working with somebody out on a mountainside, they get to talking, and especially when they're older than you, if you shut up and listen, you hear a lot of good stories.
Can you tell us some of those stories?
This is an excerpt from the story, The Cowboy and the Trapper.
And who wrote it? Who's it about?
It's about Claude Rose. His picture hangs up in the Yorkville Mini Market. He's the guy grinning beside the buck in front of the place in 1951. But the Oaks Cafe, when it was open back in the early 80s, there were still a lot of ranchers would come in there, and he was sitting there. He'd always come in every day after his chores were done, have a beer or two, and tell stories. And this young trapper came in from Nevada to kill off some of the coyotes. And Claude and Stanley Johnson, they'd spent a lot of time out there, you know, buckarooing. And so Claude said about telling this young trapper from Nevada the difference between a Nevada coyote and a Yorkville coyote. And here's a little excerpt from that story. I remember old Claude mentioning to the new trapper how, what with people being so scarce in those parts, the coyotes were easy pickings. Give a Nevada coyote a full moon, and just like a bunch of drunken cowboys on payday, they'll be out there in the wide open howling like there's no tomorrow. Or set yourself out there in the scrublands in the middle of the black night, switch on your rig's headlights, and the coyotes will gather around you just wondering what in tarnation you're up to and how that might be of some benefit to them. Or go out there in the empty country all alone, make yourself a little campfire under the rim rock, start cooking some hot dogs, and soon the coyotes will be sitting in the shadows just beyond your flickering firelight. They'll be sitting in the shadows, licking their chops at the prospect of woofing down your leave behinds. And if you were to ask them nice enough, why they'd come in out of the shadows and join you next to the fire and shoot the shit with you, and if you didn't watch out, they'd drink up all your coffee. Now, Yorkville's Coyotes, Claude Warren, and Nevada Trapper, they were of a whole different sort of background and personality. For 100 and some odd years, folks in Anderson Valley had been trying to kill off the Coyotes any which way they could think of, plus some other ways based just on hunches. So Yorkville's Coyotes, Claude declared, with a wee bit of pride showing through, had all got themselves college educations. A Yorkville Coyote, Claude swore, would as soon walk into a trapper's trap as to show mercy to a three-legged lamb or overlook a wild turkey with its head stuck in a chicken wire fence. And it goes on in that vein.
So in what time era would that be?
That conversation took place in the early 80s. I was working on a Diamond D at that time, so it'd have to be before 82.
When you heard conversations like that 20-plus, 25 years ago, did you write them down?
No.
You just remember them?
Oh, that was hilarious. That goes on to, he set up that trapper pretty good. There were a lot of other fellas there, too, that heard it. But that's how Claude was. He was a great storyteller.
But how's Pat Patterson? You hear a story once and you remember it? Do you have that facility?
I think so. If I'm impressed. I was kind of a blank slate. When I showed up in these hills, I was back from Nam. I was extremely alienated. I was all alone and bumming. I had drug problems, alcoholic, a bum, basically.
And what year was this?
I showed up in Healdsburg in 73, Yorkville in, Yorkville, spring 74, April Fool's Day. It was the first time I stepped foot in Yorkville.
How'd you wind your way up to this part of the world from having grown up? Well, you were born in Chicago, and you grew up in Southern California.
Yeah, in Los Angeles, Highland Park District, right off this Pasadena Freeway.
And you were drafted?
No, I joined the Army Infantry and volunteered for Vietnam on my 17th birthday.
What promoted you to do that?
A variety of things, mostly stay out of jail, get out from under my dad's authority. He had re-snatched me. I'd been living on the streets for a couple, 3 years. And he got legal custody of me and tried to make me fly to straight and narrow. And I didn't like that, so I decided I'd do something creative like join the Army.
And at that time, you had to get them to believe you were 18 like you do now, or get your dad's signature.
Yeah, it was a big argument. He was a World War II vet. He was a flyer in World War II, and he thought I was too young to go to war, which he was right. Of course, kids don't listen to their fathers, especially him. I mean, he couldn't tell me anything.
Could he ever later?
Yeah, we reconciled before he died. He always stuck by me. He's Irish. Irish are fiercely loyal to family. When you have nothing but families, then...
Yeah, sure. In Vietnam, what were your experiences there?
I was a rifleman on a machine gun crew. What you'd expect.
But what happened in Vietnam brought you into the leadership of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War?
Well, that happened later. When I got back from Nam... Since I was wounded, I was supposed to get my choice of duty stations, and they preempted my rights like they're doing to these guys in Iraq right now. Bottom line, they sent me back to the 82nd Airborne Act as cadre because they were going into Vietnam as reinforcements. They wanted a lot of combat veterans intermixed in the ranks to teach the guys, and I didn't want to do that, and I didn't want to jump out of airplanes anymore. So I terminated my airborne status, and they put me in a janitor company to finish off my enlistment, and I met a black fellow there up from Fort Jackson. He had a petition. Some of his buddies had been busted for having a bit session on the stoop of the barracks. And they were in the stockade, and he had a petition demanding they'd be released. And once I passed that petition, my whole world changed.
What do you mean? What did the petition say that changed your world?
Well, it was the fact that I was passing a petition.
It was the act as opposed to the content.
Right. We swore an oath that soldiers uphold the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And we didn't take an oath to the Pentagon or to the president or to Congress or to a church. It was to the Constitution.
Which includes the First Amendment.
First Amendment. And the First Amendment says Congress shall pass no law. It doesn't say some law. It says no law. And so by me passing a petition, all of a sudden I'm an enemy of the state and I'm getting persecuted. My friends are going to the stockade. And I didn't like that, so I fought back.
How'd you fight? What was the fight?
Passing more petitions. One of our first acts was to print up a few thousand copies of the American Bill of Rights and to distribute them to our fellow GIs on post. And that really drove them crazy.
Drove the...
the brass, military intelligence, FBI. When we went to town, we had the FBI on our tail. It was like we were communists. Blooded Vietnam veterans, we're communists, right?
when you went to town, which town?
Fayetteville. Fayetteville, yeah. North Carolina. And they passed. Matter of fact, because there were a lot of, there were a lot of people that thought we were traitors or cowards. We had to walk in threes and fours for self-protection. And so the Fayetteville City Council passed the ordinance that you need a parade permit for more than three GIs to be on the sidewalk. So I went to the lockup a few times behind that, civil disobedience. And then the federal court struck it down naturally.
The City Council?
Yeah.
Parade permit requirement.
Right. We had to have a permit for three or more to walk down the sidewalk. But only us, naturally.
In what year was that?
69, early 69. We started, we put out the first above ground GI newspaper. We put our name, rank, and serial numbers on the masthead. It's called Bragg Briefs. And it was about the war and racism within the ranks and Tyrell Jewelers, GI Towns. It's a whole different subculture there.
Do you think those efforts had an effect?
Oh, absolutely.
How so?
Well, we and some other GIs from different posts, because we were getting persecuted for doing nothing other than exercising our constitutional rights. We filed a suit against the president and the secretary of the army, et cetera, for violating our rights under the first, fourth, fifth, sixth, and ninth amendments of the Constitution. That worked its way up to the Supreme Court. And as a result of that, we didn't get all we wanted by any stretch, but the Uniform Code of Military Justice was reformed to give GIs in the future more judicial rights than they had under the old Uniform Code of Military Justice, which was basically a kangaroo court.
And those rights included the rights to circulate petitions and express your personal ideas?
To an extent, yeah. You would have to get the permission of the post commander.
Before you could circulate a petition?
Right, whereas before it was just verboten, period.
You couldn't do it at all?
No, they put you in jail for that.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Bruce Patterson, author of Walking Tractor and Other Tales of Old Anderson Valley. We'll be right back after a short break.
Thank you.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Bruce Patterson, who is known in the Anderson Valley area of Mendocino County in Northern California, where he lives, is Pat. Pat Anderson is the author of Walking Tractor and Other Tales of Old Anderson Valley, a small portion that has at some point, had at some point, a distinct language called Bootlink in Mendocino County, California. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Pat, your efforts, the litigation, your military experience had a significant impact on your life and adjusting or setting up your view of the world. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I was like a red-blooded American boy. I thought war was fun. You go off to war to serve your country, become a man, have fun, earn the respect of your countrymen, et cetera, et cetera. I was just a straight, patriotic young teenager. And then you get to war and you realize it's not a game and it's played for keeps, and a lot of innocent people suffer. And so it turned me. And then when I came back, once I got involved with that petition stuff, now I was in a new war, but a nonviolent one. I repudiated violence, and I struggled for about 3 years in the war. And that, as you notice, I got back from Nam in spring of 68. The war went on to 1975, so just too much of a grind. After 3-4 years in the anti-war movement, I was just completely burnt out.
At some point, you were involved in the civil rights movement as well.
My first wife was, she founded Fayetteville Area Poor People's Organization. She was a local from outside Greensboro. And she taught me a whole lot about the politics of the South and apartheid and feminism. She was a heavy, one of the early feminists. And so I hung out with those people some. And that was very educational for a street kid, you know.
So moving back to what I was asking you a few minutes ago, back to 1973 and 1974, you made your way up to Northern California, Sonoma County, Mendocino County. What was the magnet that drew you here?
Accidents. First, when I broke up with her, she broke up with me, I moved to a farm outside Raisin City in the San Joaquin Valley, and had some friends there. We were doing a collective farm there, and then I had a falling out with those people. One of my friends from there had moved to Healdsburg, a barn in Healdsburg, and I needed a place to go. So I wound up there, and I wound up working out of the rural manpower office in Healdsburg doing various, you know, casual labor jobs, ditch digging, working on vineyards, stuff like that. Then I fell in love with a woman who lived in Yorkville. And I arrived in Yorkville, and I needed a job. I started shearing sheep or stomping fleeces on a sheep shearing outfit. And then this tall, gangly guy came by and I said, "Who wants a job? $5 an hour, setting choker." And I was making $2.50 an hour stomping fleeces. I thought, hell, that sounds good. So next thing I know, I'm out setting choker on this old half-breed, legendary old cat skinner. And I fell in love with it.
Well, let's start with a description of stomping fleeces. What is that?
Well, they don't do it anymore. It's all mechanical. It's kind of hard to explain. It's basically you have a big old cotton bag. The sheep get sheared, and they throw the fleeces up into a loft, and then you suspend a bag through a hole in the loft, like an 8-foot, 36-inch cotton bag, right? And you throw a bunch of fleeces in there, and then you jump into the bag and stomp them to fill the bag. Like they used to say, like a bag would hold anywhere from far too few to never too many fleeces.
And so,
then,
in other words,
then you'd climb back out the bag and do it again, and that's how you spent your day.
And you would want to you'd want to pack that bag as full as you could with the sheep fleece.
Absolutely, those bags cost money. It costs money to ship those bags too. So the more fleeces that you get into the bag, the more economics there are.
And choke setter.
That's just slinging steel, rigging logs. A choker is like a big choke chain. Put them around a log and get sucked up to the catter. I worked under yarders, skidders. There's all different ways to skid logs.
Some of our listeners may not be from here in Mendocino County, and some of them from here, may not be familiar with those terms. You're working in the forest, and a tree has been cut. It's hit the ground, and then what?
Right, then the timber fallers, they knock the trees down, they buck the trees in the logs, take most of the limbs off, and then they get out of there. And then the rigging crew comes in, which usually be a cat and one choker setter, a footman. And the choker setter wraps the cables around the logs, hooks them up to the winch in the back of the cat, and the cat takes them to the landing. You start at the top, you work your way down.
And you drag them down the hill.
Yeah, get all the logs, yeah.
So what kind of work is that? What's it like for the man setting the choking cable?
It's brutal. Back then, it was a highballing, too, a seasonal form of employment, so you had to get what to get and was good. So you'd work 60-hour weeks, not counting travel time, and you'd highball a lot. Guys took pride in how hard they could work.
Highball? What does that mean?
Bust your ass. This is an old railroad term. If the tracks were clear ahead, there was an arm, and they'd put that ball pointing up. The high ball, and that meant go as fast as the tracks can take you.
In your book, Walking Tractor, you said you wanted to live the life of a hobo.
That's how I started off, yeah.
The freedom of a hobo. No responsibilities, no obligations.
Right, I didn't... I wanted freedom. I wanted mostly to escape the military and the military mentality, the military way of life, rules, regulations, standard operating procedures, superior ranks. You know.
Did you find it?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, where was it?
Here. Well, I wasn't a hobo. I had to work my ass off to maintain my poverty, but if I got a case of the ass, I'd quit a job in a minute.
If you got a case of the...
If I got mad, if I thought I was being treated wrong, I'd just quit. That's freedom, right? I never had a mortgage, never owned anybody any money. And as long as you're willing to work, and well, that old cowboy is saying, you always have a job as long as you're willing to work for nothing.
Pat Patterson, in your book, Walking Tractor, there are many, many beautiful colored photographs. Tell us about those.
Yeah, once I decided to write about Anderson Valley and about the old homesteader economy, I realized I had a bunch of pictures that I'd taken over the years. I'd always taken them. Then old-fashioned stories and pictures. I wanted to do it that way, have a short story with a picture that would illustrate the story or evoke the theme. And so that's how I did it. Since I'm self-publishing, I could do that. Nobody else would, no publishing company would do it. And I'm glad that I did, too, because about 10 of the pictures you can't get anymore. The barns have been torn down, or a pristine scene has been filled with a vineyard. So that's another part of the record. Like the cover photo, that's a very... very famous landmark in Anderson Valley, and I got it with a pond in front of it, and that pond's gone, and it'll never be back, so nobody ever get that picture again.
And where is this?
That's called Horse Haven. It's in at the head of Perry Gulch in Navarro.
Well, Pat, you have a website, and one of the things that you promote in your website, and obviously in addition to your book, Walking Tractor, is the development of a nature preserve in Anderson Valley?
Right. I'm just starting on that. This is a bright idea, nothing more. But on the website, there is a six-part series on this. It's a love letter to a small piece of land central to Anderson Valley that's good for nothing except a nature preserve. One short, steep water course. And in that story, it's a reprint from the Anderson Valley Advertiser. I include six pictures of the site. And I think that's a nice little addition to my website there.
And what is the website? How does one find it?
Four Mules, the number four, fourmules.com.
And you maintain it, and you have a blog in which you're trying to develop a discussion about?
Yeah. I haven't put so much into the blog that I could have. I'll be adding more to it. Then there's a news and reviews section, a sample reading, a glossary of lumberjack lingo, lots of pictures, lots of pretty pictures.
And the pictures were taken by you?
Almost all of them, yeah.
In Anderson Valley?
Yes.
In Mendocino County?
Yeah, they're all Anderson Valley pictures.
Well, Pat Patterson, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious.
Yeah, thank you.
Here in our studios. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yeah. I'm in the middle of it. It's called Highway 99, the Central Valley in Letters. It's out by Heyday Books. It's an anthology of stories about mostly the San Joaquin Valley, and lots of great stuff there.
Well, Pat Patterson, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. Bruce Patterson, known to his friends as Pat, is the author of Walking Tractor and other tales of old Anderson Valley. The book he recommends is Highway 99, a literary journey through California's Great Central Valley, an anthology of stories edited by Stan Yoki. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.